The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Well, it is indeed a new year, and Congressman Mike Garcia of the 27th Congressional District is with us on the phone. Congressman Garcia, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Larry. Thanks for having me.
And is it easy now to change from saying 25th to 27th, because you were in one of those districts that was reworked, and you should be commended because you won that district with a non-Republican majority there, which is pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of wild when you think about it. The district that I currently represent is only 29% registered Republicans, and it's a district that within this map, Biden would have won by 13% back in 2020. So this isn't a purple district. This is definitely a blue district represented by a solid conservative. So, you know, it's on the back of hard work, good communication and rational behavior, but also someone who continues to hold the conservative values, but then explain the votes. And that's the difference. We just have to communicate a little bit more probably than the average member of Congress does to their constituents. And we have well-informed voters.
Yeah. Let's start off by talking about some end-of-the-year business over on the Senate and the approval of the omnibus bill. There were some who thought, wow, this is just kind of snuck in at the last second. Republicans should have put their foot down and said, no, we're going to do it our way in January. But others said, no, we need to fund some agencies. Where do you stand on this this omnibus bill that was kind of pushed through at the end?
Well, I voted against it, and here's the reason. It's too big. It's roughly half a billion or so too big. Half a trillion too big. It came in at $1.7 trillion, and when you look at our nation's annual operating budget from the year 2008 to the year 2018, we were typically around $1.3 trillion a year, and these are the bills that, you know, fund pretty much every federal agency, Department of Education, but also our military, the DOD. About half of it is DOD. So this particular bill, not only was it late, roughly 3 months late relative to what we should be doing, we're supposed to pass a budget by September 30th, but it was done behind closed doors with only a handful of members from the Senate really pulling this together along with maybe leadership in the House. And then it was, like I said, about a half a trillion dollars too tall. So this is dysfunctional government at its worst. This is, you know, them kicking the can from a budgeting perspective throughout the year and waiting until we are all on the cliff's edge and waiting till we're going on Christmas vacation. And then making this thing so swollen and so ridden with fat. I mean, this thing was 4,000 pages long. And when you do the math, Larry, that comes out to about $700 million per page on average. And that's ridiculous. So we've got to get to sound government. Now that we have the majority in the House, at least, we're going to be, and I sit on the Appropriations Committee. This is where the budgeting process takes place. We've got to get back down to the legacy spending values and start making cuts and start leaning out some of these federal agencies. This government has gotten too big. It's gotten too powerful, and we've got to start leaning it out. And that starts with cuts in the House and staying on timeline, staying on budget. And we've got to be more responsible with the taxpayer dollars. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Congressman Mike Garcia with us. I was reading, that there was something in there that, you know how they put up these stories on the MSN page where you kind of click and see what's about. It says, did you know that in this bill hidden is auto shutoff for vehicles regulations that are going to mean that, you know, in high speed chases, police can shut down a vehicle? And, you know, they're getting everybody thinking about that. And some Republicans have said, no, we didn't really want to go that far because we don't want the government state to have control of every vehicle. But I get it. In high speed chases, you kind of want something. something like that, an auto shutoff piece of legislation, if it is indeed embedded in that, is that a good thing or bad thing?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'd have to look at the details, and that's the problem with these bills, these omnibus bills are, you know, 4,000 pages is the bottom line. That really has nothing to do with our annual operating budget at the national level, right? So with all of these things, the devil's in the details or something like that, I wouldn't be opposed to it if we knew what the controls were, who had access to the data, who had access to the levers that controlled this, and what the protocols were for maintaining privacy and security on these systems. So, but the problem is everyone kind of throws their own pet projects, in this case, you know, some sort of shutoff system for high-speed car chases into these omnibus packages, and they have nothing to do with the spending bill. And so in the majority, we have passed a rule here that will basically require Congress to take up one bill at a time, and it has to be germane. If there's any amendments to the bill, it has to be germane to that topic. So if it's a spending bill, it can only be spending items. If it's a defense authorization bill, it can only be related to defense. And so that we're only voting on things that are on the docket for that day and only relative and germane to that piece of legislation. So that's how we're going to sort of prevent this type of boondoggle from happening, where literally everything in the kitchen sink is being thrown at every spending bill.
Yeah, it's a new year, a new structure for how things work with the Republican slim majority in the House. There are obviously going to be investigations du jour over there now, things that haven't been investigated before. But on the other hand, you can investigate all you want, but if certain things aren't done to improve things, there's going to be a lot of frustrated Republicans.
Yeah, no, you have to do both. And I've been saying this for several months here, as it was looking obvious that we were going to get the majority back. We had too many folks looking at only one of two things, either the investigations or the legislative side. And the bottom line is that we have to do both. We have to hold this executive branch accountable. We've got to look at what happened in Afghanistan, what's going on our southern borders, what's happening with Hunter Biden, what's happening with the weaponization of the FBI and the DOJ. But in parallel, we still do have to pass the laws. We have to get this economy back on track. We have to cut spending. We have to make the tough decisions so that we can start fighting this inflation problem. And I'm confident we're going to be able to do that. You know, this is the press isn't on our side. The media is certainly not an enabler of the conservative paradigm and principles, and certainly not our platform. So we've got to make sure that we're communicating this to our constituents and going on radio shows like yours to make sure that the voters do understand that we are holding people accountable. We will be doing these investigations, but we are also legislating, and we can do both in parallel without sacrificing one to the other. And that's going to be a stark contrast to what we just experienced under Nancy Pelosi here for the last several years.
As for you personally, are you looking at any special committees or assignments that may be in the works that you can talk about, or do we just need to see how it unfolds?
Yeah, I can't really talk about it yet. I am looking for something for new opportunities. I will stay on the Appropriations Committee, and I'm looking to hopefully rotate into the Defense Subcommittee within the Appropriations Committee. I'm hoping to also remain a co-chair of the China Task Force. The China Task Force will be made basically a select committee now with hopefully bipartisan support. But Mike Gallagher is going to be leading that task force. I'll be the co-chair of that. And then there's a couple other things I'm not at liberty to talk about quite yet, but looking forward to that. It's very exciting, and it's going to be a tremendous opportunity. And what's kind of interesting is, you know, I'm technically in my junior year, my junior session here, but I'm still just shy of 3 years in Congress. So it's a unique opportunity to be in my third term and not be there, you know, quite 3 years. It's pretty special. So to be on the Appropriations Committee, to be a co-chair of China Task Force, and hopefully this other thing here shortly that we can talk about in a couple weeks will be a tremendous opportunity for not just myself, but the district and for the nation when it comes to national security items especially.
What do you think is the biggest threat or threats facing our country right now? You keep referencing to inflation and the concerns there, and, of course, this omnibus bill with all its spending. How do you reel that stuff in if we continue to spend?
Yeah, that is probably the the biggest threat, the closest alligator to the canoe, and maybe there's two, I would say, are China and our debt. And the debt one is compounded and aggravated by the fact that China underwrites about a third of our debt, right? So we are falling behind in several domains relative to China. They are growing exponentially with their space programs, their cyber programs, their unmanned aerial vehicle. We've seen what they've been able to do from a biological perspective with COVID, whether they did it on purpose or not. And this is another one of these investigations that we need to run to ground to hold China accountable and get to the root cause of where COVID originated, who's funding the gain of function elements of it. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, the external threat is China, and then the internal threat really is our debt that we've created. And so if we can't get the debt under control, if we can't continue to build the defense against China, then we are vulnerable. And I would submit we're vulnerable today. And so far, we've been losing this conflict with China over the last 5-6 years, and we're certainly losing the war on the debt and deficit spending, and we got to get that under control.
Over the holidays, we had the Supreme Court extending Title 42. You had others saying that doesn't really matter because the Biden administration doesn't really, you know, kick very many people out. Where are you on the border, and what are you watching there?
Well, it does matter. As bad as it is down there right now over the last 2 years, you know, I think we're up to, 200,000 people coming across the border now that are being tracked. God knows how many are not being tracked. This is a result of the executive branch basically just not enforcing the border and effectively communicating to the globe that we're willing to take people in without any checks and balances there and release you. If you are caught, you'll be released on your own recognizance and sort of shotgunned around the country. Title 42 mitigated that somewhat. It gave some leverage to the Border Patrol agents to help stop the bleeding. And I visited the border a few times now over the last couple of years, and that's the one thing that they point to that says the only thing preventing this nightmare, this crisis from becoming catastrophic at a level that we wouldn't be able to manage is Title 42. So it is important as broken and incompetent and negligent and derelict that this executive branch has been. I'm very grateful for the Supreme Court stepping in and extending Title 42. This is, you know, a tourniquet right now on a bleeding southern border that is desperately needed. The short answer and the easy answer, frankly, is for this president to recognize that it is a crisis and to actually secure the border and get back to the policies, the Remain in Mexico policies and the previous administration, the policies of the previous administration were implementing to make sure that we actually do have a secure border right now. We absolutely do not have a secure border. Anyone that reports otherwise or asserts otherwise is just lying. So this is a national security crisis. And again, China's moving goods, and most importantly, the compounds that build fentanyl or fentanyl itself across our southern border to the point where we're losing more lives right now in this country to fentanyl than we ever have in our nation's history. And I think that the numbers are staggering. Over 100,000 a year, I think, now dying of fentanyl poisonings. These aren't overdoses. These are poisoning coming across the southern border.
Congressman Mike Garcia, where can people follow you online?
Online, yeah, electmikegarcia.com and all the social media is there as well. So appreciate the support. We're running all over again here. It's going to be another tight race and every 2 years in the House, as you know. So looking forward to representing now the 27th Congressional District.
Thank you, as always. And again, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Larry. Thanks.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
John Kabatak is the California Director of NFIB, and he is joining us right now to talk about all things business when it comes to the past year and to look ahead at this year. And thank you so much for joining us. Happy New Year to you, John.
Hey, Happy New Year to you too, Larry. Great to be back on the program and always good to talk to you, my friend.
Usually we get on the air and we talk about all the things that are wrong, bad things, bad bills, legislators that don't get it. You want to talk about some of the maybe silver linings, some of the things that maybe didn't happen this past year and things that we can look forward to this year. Let's start there.
That's true. I think we should talk about some of the beautiful ornaments on the, or at least some good looking ornaments on the Christmas tree versus just the lumps of coal, right, Larry?
Yes, of course. And you're the one, you keep yours up through January, right?
Easily. It may be sometimes March. I'm pretty pathetic that way, but I'm in denial about the holidays being over. So, yeah, well, you know, we there were some good things. You know, there are certainly California legislators and our policymakers, you know, there's no dearth with our capital leaders when it comes to some of the bad stuff, making California such a hostile climate. But there were some good things this past year, and I think some things that NFIB, our small business group, really fought for, and others in the job creator community. You know, number one, no new taxes. You know, we were told by Governor Newsom's business director, Dee Dee Myers, she told us directly on our lobby day at NFIB, absolutely no new taxes. They heard that loud and clear. I think the concern is with a $100 billion deficit now, this looking ahead, what will they do? Will the progressives be salivating at that to raise questions? The other thing is we got some financial support for small businesses to make their businesses more ADA compliant. There's an extension of this $4 fee that is paid that was continued. And while that we never like fees, this money comes back to the small business owners so they don't become victims to lawsuits, these frivolous lawsuits, and they will get some ability to get some financial support to make their businesses compliant. And then the last one, Larry, that I really point to is, hey, we, out of the new members elected to the legislature, there were some Democrat and Republican small business friendly candidates that were elected. You know, NFIB was engaged on both sides of the aisle, but the bottom line also is we're going to see how they vote this year. We'll be keeping an eye, but we're hopeful that we have more business owners elected and more who actually get small business. So we're just praying that that translates into action on voting day, right?
Do you think lawmakers in Sacramento get it with the net outflow of people in the state and businesses leaving, that there are some challenges that they need to be sensitive to, that the business environment, the regulation environment is such that it's getting harder and harder for this state to compete?
Well, I think so. And I think that was reflected on Election Day with, you know, frankly, voters in even the blue to purple districts and areas, you know, progressively saying, look, we have had it. We've had it with crime, homelessness, inflation. We can't deal with the status quo anymore. So I think, Larry, what we're finding is the policymakers are finally, hopefully, listening. They're going back to their districts. They're seeing small businesses on Main Street boarded up. They're seeing their own family members and friends out of work. And they're frankly seeing prices going up in every store. So at the end of the day, I think they can't be in denial anymore, like I am about Christmas, Larry, being over, that they can't be in denial about businesses leaving California. And they're seeing those boxes being filled up and those U-Hauls taken off. So I think finally we're seeing the elected hopefully getting a message, and certainly the voters that reflected that a little bit more this past election. Yeah.
And with energy costs in California spiking and an administration in Sacramento that is dead set on doing away with petroleum and shutting down refineries and not allowing fracking or drilling, it is tough to compete with the costs that we pay, which are significantly higher than other states. You know, those lights that you're keeping up at the house, the power to run those is considerably more than last year, right?
Oh, there is no question about it. And there's a couple things that really have us very concerned this year ahead, as we look ahead. Number one, yes, the governor and the legislature are convening this special session just starting this month in January on oil tax profits, on oil profits. The problem is, I think that they're pointing the finger in the wrong direction. We have policies that our Air Resources Board has promulgated that is raising the cost of gas and regulations on businesses. You know, I think at the end of the day, nobody wants dirty emissions. Emissions and that are dirty are bad, but oil and petroleum are not bad, and we have those in plenty supply. So that's one big concern is this special session. Will that result in taxes on Main Street? And then the other part that was just approved about a week ago, Larry, is this new scoping plan, very sweeping scoping plan by the Air Resources Board, require, listen to this, all vehicles and machineries to be electrified by the year 2035. This caters to the elite who can only those can afford Teslas, right? The worst part is it's going to bust our electricity grid by forcing everybody to be electrified in their machinery and vehicles. At the end of the day, we're about one forest fire away from our whole electrical grid shutting down, and that's bad for everybody.
Well, and we went through a summer not long ago where they told everybody, hey, you know, don't charge electric vehicles right now, please, because we have this challenge of the grid. If we put everything on the grid, we couldn't sustain things. And yet there's no acknowledgement of that, no discussion of that, no response to that complaint when you make it, is there?
There really isn't. You know, I will say, you know, one thing that NFIB, we got very aggressive in a digital campaign last year, and we had over a million different visitors and a number of folks really speak out to the Air Resources Board along with other job creator groups. The good news is we are having conversations with the chair of the Air Board and the members and their staff on a regular basis, at least to make sure we're getting better outcomes here. But at the end of the day, Larry, you're right. I mean, this electrical grid, if it bursts, imagine main streets on blackout for weeks upon end. And that is where we're headed if we don't do this right.
Yeah, they're so interested in their philosophy of climate change, and they're just leaving behind anyone and the cost incurred in the process. And I get it. We maybe need to convert, but convert when you have something that that works, that is going to be equal to and provide us the energy we need. And so many products are made, by the way. My friends who are experts in petroleum say all the plastics and medical supplies and tubing are made with petroleum products. And how can you say no to that? We don't have any replacement in that area, right? I mean, okay, we have straws that they can make paper straws. Have you used one of those paper straws lately? Something's wrong with them. They don't feel right, do they?
No, they don't. I mean, my mouth is usually full of paper in my teeth because the straws are so terrible. But I also think that they're pointing the finger again in the wrong direction. I think we need to get our policymakers in line with better policies that keep things in check. We're all for cleaner, safer communities. You know, vehicles that will be less, you know, that will actually save money for consumers. But we're not there yet. The technology isn't there yet. And here is, once again, our policymakers pushing forth a mandate without the technology to back it up, or without the infrastructure, Larry, I need my coffee this morning, without the infrastructure, Larry, to back it up. So at the end of the day, that's terrible.
And you mentioned crime, public safety issues. We've seen the images on TV of the smash and grabs where they break through the windows and go in with the baseball bats and raid a place, and we have these rules that say we can charge you for $900, you know, a day, and that's about the limit on it. And, you know, you get convenience stores that kind of get attacked like that. A lot of nuisance crimes as well. There's drugs in our streets, fentanyl. You mentioned the homeless issue. All these factors that take a once golden California and tarnish up its image a bit, don't they?
It really does. And I think, you know, last year, for example, you talk about retail crimes. You know, there's a lot of talk right now about these organized retail crimes against Saks Fifth Avenue and, you know, the large CVS and Walmart stores. But very little attention has been focused on what we're doing to stop these shoplifters who are going in. The more commonplace crimes right now are those who are going into these little retail stores and they're taking stuff to feed their habit. Until Proposition 47, which actually raised, you may remember, and voters approved this in 2014, raised the threshold of a property crime from $450 to $950. You're basically, and they're not allowing that to aggregate, you're basically giving these shoplifters free rein, and then we're not funding our law enforcement locally. So our leaders need to address this head on. They need to fund our law enforcement better, and they need to reform Proposition 47, if not completely eliminated. So we've got to fix that.
And there's bail issues as well. It just seems as if many of our legislators are just bent on doing away with cash bail entirely. There's this commission that has been set up it's suggesting that taxpayers reimburse people for crime. And I don't know, I haven't really wrapped my head around whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, but you know, it ought to be the people who perpetrate crimes that pay, don't you think?
Absolutely. You know, listen, the voters have spoken, the legislature has spoken. Two or three times now, there has been a rejection of this idea of either eliminating the bail process or reducing it to $0. There is no doubt that folks on all sides of the aisle have agreed that we should try and look at a better way to fix the bail system and improve it. But to eliminate it or reduce that, you're right. It's basically the criminals should be the ones on the hook. And at the end of the day, also, this is allowing them, we're hearing from DAs, we're hearing from sheriffs and others, and judges, they're just thumbing their nose because they know that they will go back out on the street and reoffend if this is a policy. People who want to find out more about NFIB can go to nfib.com, nfib.com. And we do have a California page that has a whole list of all the new laws for 2023. And we do encourage all your listeners out there who are small business owners to talk to their HR people.
Thank you, John.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Coming up, a conversation with Lori Burns from theteenproject.com. She is with us today to tell us all about another nonprofit organization. Good to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us the story behind this.
Well, the Teen Project is based in Orange County, California, where I grew up. In foster care, and when foster care ended, I was trafficked. That's the short version. So I was on the street for several years, and my life was saved by a Good Samaritan after I'd been kidnapped by gang members who were going to kill me. And since then, I've been taking in foster kids and opened a charity.
Is the problem related to the fact that foster kids kind of term out at 18 and don't have anywhere to go or have resources? Is that kind of the story behind this, or explain what gets you there?
Yes, that is the story behind the foster children. They age out of 18. They are homeless after foster care. It used to be 50% are homeless after foster care, and it's gotten a little bit better, but not much. Yeah, foster care ends, and they've got no parents, no money, no cell phone, no car, and they are prey to the predators on the street.
So how, in your case, without naming names, how did you get, I don't want to say inducted in or captured in? What was the process?
You know, it's interesting. It was by a family member at first, and that is the case for most of the kids. It's a family member or a friend of the family that seems safe. That brings you into it. And then after that, you're just prey to whoever's out there.
So
that was how it happened. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what happened? What was life like?
Life was miserable. The day that I was abducted while working the streets in Santa Ana, I preferred to die. I actually screamed and begged those men to kill me. I had nothing left to live for. And that, I believe, is why they left me there without killing me, because they thought someone was coming. There was absolutely nothing left to live for. When you feel like no one cares for you, there's no one coming to rescue you, this is the anticipated end for you. There's just no will to live anymore. And today, I think, you know, it's worse than it was even then. That was in the 80s. So today it's worse because most kids are being trafficked online, which is something I talk a lot about, because I want to warn the parents that if your kids are on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and Snapchat, disappearing messages, they are prey to the predators. And now the predators are hiding in plain sight. So most of the girls we're getting today are actually trafficked on the internet.
So tell us your story of the Good Samaritan who got you out of this life.
Well, I was taken into a canyon by gunmen who were going to abuse me, not being specific, and all night and kill me in the morning. And when I started screaming, they beat me and left me for dead on the side of the road. And this man was traveling down the canyon road and must have saw my body in the brush and pulled over. And I don't know how many people would have pulled over, but he pulled over, and I actually fought him because I thought he was going to hurt me. I didn't know who he was, and men were not safe for me at this point. And I fought him to leave me alone. And he was a big black guy, kind of looked like the Green Mile guy, and literally picked me up like a puppet to his face, because I was under 90 pounds at that point. And he was crying, and he said, please. Would you please just let me help you? I'm just going to get you to a hospital. I'm not going to hurt you. And for the first time in a long time, I trusted someone, and that man saved my life.
So what took that experience to creating a nonprofit to help others?
Well, I started taking in foster kids as a single parent when I was 25. And I took in 46 foster kids over my lifetime. But I started realizing when I was asked to serve on the Foster Care Advisory Board in our county that kids all over the place were still going homeless. Up to this point, I thought it was my own bad luck. And my foster kids stayed with me until they were ready to move out. So at that point, I called my best friend. I was actually working in the field of technology at that point. I was a director at Northrop Grumman Corporation, which is a whole nother story. And she was a realtor. And I said, let's get on LegalZoom and start a little charity. And we just wanted to help a few kids at that point. We didn't know what we could do. But let me just tell you, the floodgates opened. I think when the universe puts you on a path, your goal or endeavor in life should be to create a purpose by helping other people out of that path, rather than look at yourself and say, why did I go through this? To take a step back and go, how can I help others get out of this? Right. And that's what happened.
So you refer to the floodgates being open. What kind of numbers did you start seeing coming for assistance?
Our first grant, we didn't know how to write grants. It was kind of like throwing spaghetti at the fridge, see if it sticks. And if it does, we keep on doing it that way. Our first grant, big grant that we asked for, was $100,000. We didn't have any employees. We didn't have any real estate. And we asked for $100,000. They called us right before Christmas and said they wanted to give us $125,000. So that was our first grant. Since then, we've had three people wire $1 million to us. One person that didn't know us, who had just read my life story they got my book on Amazon, Punished for Purpose, which is my life story, and wired us $1 million. So since that time, we've received $52 million in grants and donations. We have 126 beds, and we have two new sites in development. And that will bring us to 180 beds by March. And we are Tri-County, Orange County, Riverside, Los Angeles.
We talk about the subject of fostering on our program quite a bit. And what you're talking about is a huge flaw in the system, dumping kids at 18, because they don't have the resources and they don't have the network that extends to them, in most cases, do they, to survive.
No, they don't. And just to give you some education on this, there is a thing called AB-12 in California and many other states that says you can extend foster care to 21. The problem is when you're close up and really into the nuts and bolts of this whole thing, when your kids are 18 and they've been moved from place to place and abused in the system, they want out. So they try and get out. Then they've got to re-enter to get those services that they were offered to age 21. In order to re-enter, you have to be, there's five key items, and you have to meet three of them. And some of them are have a full-time job, have a place to live, have schooling or education, right? So those are choices. But the kids that are homeless can't access that. And in order to get a full-time job or have a place to live, they need money, but they can't access the money until they get the requirements completed. So they're stuck.
It's a conundrum.
And most people don't realize that.
A vicious cycle makes it tough to break and to get that help. And I'm also, in my discussions on fostering, the admission that there's little or no resources to help kids, even within the program, to do anything special. Music lessons, things that, you know, a child might have in a traditional home with a mother and father, there's little to no resources. That money gets eaten up by the system.
Correct. That is true. And you think, if you looked at the ROI on the whole thing, leaving kids on the street and then they re-enter through welfare and emergency services, hospitalization, jails, we actually spend more money by leaving them there than actually finishing the job. So if you've looked at the teen project and what we offer, it's the same things I was offered when I was saved from the street. So I was offered a couple things, drug treatment. If you look at all the homeless shelters these days, they do low barrier entry. You familiar with that? So really no requirements to stay in the shelter. That is the HUD guidance, right? So you can use drugs, you can use alcohol. They really can't tell you what to do. They want you to get services, and then hopefully through getting housing, you will access other services. That is not our jive. we must be sober. In order for a girl to come into our program, they must have the ability or the desire to stay sober. We do drug detox, drug treatment, and we're Joint Commission accredited like a hospital. So we have a very high level of services that we offer and a lot of audits.
Yeah,
ensure we are meeting those requirements.
I've heard the same thing that you're talking about, no drugs, from Andy Bales over at Union Rescue Mission. And he says having that stance has done him out of tons of money in government grants.
Correct.
They all want this, bring people in wet housing where they can do drugs and shoot up. And,
correct.
It doesn't work.
Actually sent a check in the amount of $500,000 back to Los Angeles County and said, sorry, we're not doing it. And they kept on sending us checks and you've been approved for another one. And we're just laughing going, we're not taking it. We literally took some money from them and took some of these kids into our 100-bed facility in Los Angeles. And it was like Lord of the Flies. They were bringing weed in. If we searched them or tested them, we were audited and written up. So we said, forget it. We don't want your money. And we were willing to do that because, look, if you have kids, are you going to let your kids do drugs, alcohol, and still pay their rent? No. So we love these kids. We're going to treat them like we treat our kids. And we're going to make sure they do what they need to do in order to get the support they get. And they do. We get about 400 kids a year coming into our place.
Very powerful, what you're talking about. You have a chance to talk to people on the radio listening, coming at this from very different places. If someone mm-hmm. is listening in need, if someone is a recent, aged out of the foster care system and is on the streets, what would you suggest they do? Who should they contact?
First of all, they should call the hotline. It's 800-685-7460, and they will be patched into a live person. I don't know how many people know this, but if you see posters in the airport or wherever you're traveling about human trafficking, call this number. Be a secret shopper. Pretend you're a girl being trafficked. Call that number. See if you're going to get help. Because I find that most of the places that are marketing that they're helping trafficking victims immediately are not. You call the number, you get three more numbers. You call those numbers, you get appointments, referrals, voicemails. We are one of the few that have a 24/7 hotline that's attached to a live person to get you in today.
We are sadly out of time. Give us your website. Give us a contact email or number, whatever you like to do. You got about 20 seconds.
The Teen Project, like teenagers with double E, theteenproject.com is the website. And the hotline is 800-685-7460. We want to help more people. If you see a girl on the street, give them the contact information and get them to us.
Say that number once again.
800-685-7460.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today. Lori Burns,
appreciate you for having me.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Coming up, a conversation with Mike Welsh. He is the CEO of Working Dogs for Warriors and their website, workingdogsforwarriors.com. It's an Inland Empire nonprofit. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Larry. I appreciate it.
Tell us the story behind WorkingDogsForWarriors.com.
So Working Dogs for Warriors is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to assisting our veterans and first responders overcome the post-traumatic stress they deal with and really combating suicide in our veterans and first responders. We help them by training and donating service dogs to them. We have wellness programs. We have a pantry program. And then we do a lot of stuff in our community to kind of get them back integrated into daily life, really.
Give us a sense for how big a challenge this is. I mean, obviously, any life lost to suicide from PTSD is one too many, but what are we talking numbers-wise? What have you, as you look at this issue, how big is it?
Well, the statistics a few years ago, they always talk about 22 a day is lost to suicide in our veteran community. Unfortunately, that number is significantly higher now due to COVID and the isolation and all that. They're seeing numbers closer to 37, I believe, a day, which is unfathomable. Just by us being able to provide these dogs to them, we have veterans who pretty much reach out to us hoping it's going to help, hoping that a dog will help them, you know, so we pair them up with dogs, but not only that, you know, we create a family for them to be able to come out and participate in training and have other brothers and sisters who are also going through the same things as them, you know, to be able to have those conversations on, you know, knowing that they're not alone, knowing that their struggles aren't only theirs to burden, you know, that they have someone to talk to, you know, that's where the healing comes from, you know, being able to come out and talk and just get it off their chest, you know, and not allowing it to bottle up inside.
So are the dogs more a catalyst in this, that they get the soldier, the warrior, the vet out of isolation and doing things, and in the process they're talking with people and can share their stories? Or is it the dog itself that is the therapy, or both?
Both, actually. You know, like we have guys who don't like to go to amusement parks or don't like to go to even shopping, you know, a supermarket or the mall or anything like that, especially during holidays, you know, where it's just so overly crowded, you know, and having that dog be there with them, you know, to provide those tasks for them, grounding techniques, you know, that helping them just know that they're not alone. You know, they don't always have to have that hypervigilance. You know, having that dog there helps them, one, get back into that life, and it helps calm them down. You know, there's all kinds of studies showing that dogs help release endorphins and all that, where it's scientifically proven to lower stress levels. You know, so giving these warriors a dog to help with that, you know, and then get them back integrated in those types of situations, you know, it's amazing. Like, just a couple weeks ago, actually, we went out to Knott's Berry Farm with six of our service dogs and six of our veterans and their service dogs. You know, and each of them said, oh, we would have never done this by ourselves, you know, or even with their family, you know, like, but bringing out with their dog and with us, you know, gives them that reassurance on, hey, it's okay. You know, now, you know, having those conversations afterwards, now, hey, they might want to go back, or they're already planning on going back, or they got a pass, you know, just being able to live life how they want to, you know, but with PTS, it's there's just extra challenges that are associated with it.
So tell us what your costs are. I mean, obviously, keeping, maintaining, and training dogs is not an inexpensive thing to be involved with, is it?
No, yeah. So the average cost of a service dog is roughly $30,000, and that's from start to finish. You know, there's 360 training hours that goes into each of our dogs, but the average cost that a veteran or a first responder pays is zero. You know, and we take pride in that, in not charging them a dime. You know, being able to fundraise and have events, you know, do fundraisers and all that, where, you know, we get the community involved in it, so the community knows that they're making a difference also. You know, that's where the biggest thing is. Having, like, we just did a spaghetti night at the end of last year, a spaghetti night fundraiser, you know, and we had veterans come out, we had our community come out, you know, and it's great seeing everyone kind of talk and bring mental health to the forefront. You know, it's important to talk about mental health, you know, and it's not something that's commonly done in those types of professions. But I think having these dogs, having those conversations, you know, having these events is really going to help pave the way for people who are out there seeking help, but just don't know how to.
Sure. How do you fundraise? Well, you mentioned the spaghetti dinner is one, but you take gifts, donations, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we take all donations. We have a on our website, workingdogsforwarriors.com. We have a general donation platform on there where people could do like monthly or reoccurring donations, or just like a one-time donation. And then throughout the year, we do several events. Like I mentioned, the spaghetti night. We do a barbecue closer to spring. But we're planning all that stuff now, so hopefully we'll have that all live on our website or Instagram and Facebook, which is at Working Dogs for Warriors. You know, so we can just get the community come out. We do a couple car show events that we go out to. We sell shirts and challenge coins and hats whenever we do have them. But, you know, it's great being able to see the community come out and the community actually caring enough to want to support, which is amazing.
Sure. Well, tell us the launch story. How did this officially get started, and when did it get started?
So we started Working Dogs for Warriors in 2016. It originally was started by myself, my wife, and my late brother-in-law. Unfortunately, he passed away the same month as we submitted our paperwork from a car accident. You know, so once that happened, obviously our family was very shooken up. We kind of put it on the back burner for a little bit. But then a few months later, probably roughly about 6 months later, we kind of pushed it again, and we're doing anything, everything in the memory of Daniel. You know, that was, that's my brother-in-law. You know, just really focusing on the mental health aspect of things. You know, my grandfather was a Marine, Vietnam era Marine, suffered severe PTSD, night terrors, you know, that whole array of things, you know, and just seeing him have to shift through a box of medication, you know, in order to function, then cut to several years later, you know, now I'm older. I have friends who went to the military and came back, and the answers were the same thing, you know, where they have, they're having night terrors, they're having, you know, these bouts of PTS, and their options is medication, you know, and I'm like, that's not a way to live, you know? So being able to get these guys paired with dogs, you know, just, we've had multiple veterans come and tell us, like, when they first got a dog, they go back to the VA, you know, with the routine appointments and stuff, and the VA is like, hey, what's going on? You know, you seem different, you seem happier, you're going out more, and they're like, well, I got a dog, you know, and just that alone makes it worth it. You know, knowing that we're actually making a difference in these lives of these warriors, it means the world to us.
You mentioned some of the symptoms. Describe them a little bit more, because there may be some veterans listening who wonder about this program. You said night terrors. Is that what you call them?
Yeah, night terrors. My grandpa would always explain it like having flashbacks in the middle of the night and just not being able to wake up from them. You know, and just reliving those instances of trauma, whether it's military service or a firefighter on a bad call or a police officer going out to a bad call, you know, those traumas are there, but our body processes them in different ways, you know, so being able to realize that, you know, knowing you're not alone in that, you know, we're here to help. You know, we have a peer support program that meets every week where veterans and first responders can come out and talk, you know, just bring up what they're going through, challenges or like happy times that they're dealing with, you know, just to bring that community together, you know, knowing that they're not alone in that struggle, you know, because that's one of the biggest things, that they are not alone. You know, we want to make sure that they know that they have an option, you know, that suicide isn't the only option for them. You know, reach out to us, give us a call. I'd be happy to talk to you. You know, and we'd be happy to sit down. We have a kennel with dogs in it where we can take a couple of dogs out on a walk, you know, and just talk, you know. And I've had veterans do that, you know, reach out to us, and they come out to the kennels and they participate in just cleaning up the kennels, walking dogs for a bit. And then they realize, hey, I think I do need a dog, you know, and then we get them paired up. We get them plugged into all of our brother programs, you know, and that makes a difference.
Sounds like it does. What is the first process to get started? If you know a veteran, if you are a veteran, if you think you have PTSD and you'd like to see about whether having a dog would make a difference, what do you want them to do?
Absolutely. You can go onto our website. It's workingdogsforwarriors.com. Click on service dogs, and we do have an application process there. Once they do the application, we like to bring in a group of them, sit them down, learn about their needs for a service dog, and then teach them about our program. Our program is a little different than others out there, as we don't just train, you know, we don't have dogs trained up ready to go and then we take them in for a 2-week course. It's training hands-on with that dog, you know, so we try to find a dog and pair them with a dog early in that dog's life, so they have one of the longest working life, you know, they build that relationship with the dog, you know, so it is a little longer of a program, but we found that that's where all of the healing comes from, is actually coming out, participating in those trainings, participating in volunteering together, you know. You know, so there's a lot of ways we can get them plugged in.
Where do you get your dogs?
Rescues, shelters, and then we do have some breeders who donate dogs to us.
Is there a particular breed that works really well, you found?
We like any working breed, really. Lab shepherds, retrievers, Dobermans, Rottweilers, you know, anything that has a drive. And once we figure out what drive it has, we like to pair that drive to that veteran, you know, showing the dog that, building the bond with that dog and that veteran, you know, that's the biggest thing, you know, so that's when we get veterans who, like, sometimes they don't want to go outside, you know, they have that hypervigilance or that seclusion, you know, where they just don't want to go in crowds and stuff, but getting a dog who's going to get them out, you know, get them, getting them to go on hikes, you know, go out for walks, knowing that they need to care for the animal. You know, that's also one of the other healing factors of it.
Final 30 seconds. Give us the information, name of the organization, the website, and maybe even a contact email or phone number.
Yeah. So again, it's Working Dogs for Warriors. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, at Working Dogs for Warriors. My email is mwelsh@workingdogsforwarriors.com.
Mike Welch, CEO, Working Dogs for Warriors. Thank you so much for being with us on the program. Very interesting. Good deeds you're doing here in Southern California. Take care.
I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.